Yeah, Gil reminded me when I had dinner with him the other night, he looked at me when I had forgotten. He said that he'll always think of me as his boss because of that relation. It's a very special relationship, the Tenzo Fukuten, the head cook, assistant cook relationship, and very intimate practice. I was thinking of starting with a, since I come from the Zen tradition, that I'd start with a Zen koan, which is not a typical Zen koan, because this koan has an answer to it. But the koan is, what is the difference between a Dharma talk and stand-up comedy? Right? And I'll tell you the answer, but it's not really the answer. You'll have to think about it, But the answer is that stand-up comedy isn't always funny. Right? And that's about as funny as I get. So, although I've been playing with this idea of, I really think particularly Zen practice really needs more humor, and there seems to be. I notice when I walk into, I was at Green Gulch the other day, and I was walking down the field, and I struck up a conversation with this woman who was, I opened the gate for her, and we just started talking, and she turned to me and she said, I've been here for 3 days, and this is the first conversation that I've had that people at Green Gulch don't seem to be all. They have a reputation, and it's often a deserved reputation. But I explained to her the other side of that is what attracted me to Zen Center was that when I first walked in the doors at 300 Page Street, that no one seemed to care whether I was there or not, and I found that very attractive, that there was no proselytizing. I didn't find people to be unfriendly, but I liked the spaciousness. What I want to talk about tonight is a particular practice. And again, as you all know, all the practices in Buddhism are really about how to be happy and how to face and transform our suffering and pain and discomfort and to be happy and to help other people. And the particular practice I wanted to talk about in this short time. Well, Gil did tell you this was the beginning of a 7-day sesshin that we were all. it seems quite a challenge to in a few minutes to try and say something. I don't have relationships with very very few of you, so it's a challenge. But the practice I want to talk about, which I'm sure is one that you hear a lot about, but I don't know how it's usually presented, so maybe I'll present it in a little bit different way. But it's the practice of dana prajnaparamita, the practice of giving, the practice of generosity. But there's a particular aspect of dana that I want to focus on, which is giving the gift of fearlessness. The way we generally think about the practice of generosity and giving are, right, there's giving material goods. Also, the other side of that, which is also an interesting practice, is the practice of receiving things. Sometimes it can be more challenging or even require a different kind of fearlessness to be able to receive things without anything extra, like to receive a compliment or to receive something, or to receive a smile. Someone might just want to give us a smile at a time and place where. So are we open to that? Are we fearless? Do we have enough space that we can receive someone's compliment, someone's gift, or someone's smile? Giving is also talked about as being giving, being generous with our presence, with our joy, with our attention. And again, it's I think of the fearlessness aspect that I feel underlies all these practices of giving, that it's not about giving in order to receive something. It's not about giving to get something. It's not about giving to look good or to get great things. It's about this practice of fearlessness. I was thinking about, there was a time not so long ago when it seemed like there were a lot of things that were going wrong in my life all at the same time. It was kind of, it was strange in that it seemed to start with when I came out of a restaurant one day and noticed that one of my tires in my car was quite low, and I took it into the gas station and was surprised to find that not only was there a nail, but there were two nails, two very, very different nails that were about an inch apart. And when I came home that day, I noticed that the furnace in my house wasn't working. So I called PG&E, and they sent someone out, and the PG&E guy pointed out that the little wooden deck that leads up to my furnace was rotten, that the boards were rotten, and that he couldn't fix it because it was not safe to go up on these boards. And it was the same day that I got a call from the bank saying that my account was overdrawn, that I had made some... It was all very, very strange. And I happened that night to pick up a book, and it was some commentary about Tibetan Buddhism, in which someone was quoting an assistant of the Dalai Lama, who said that when a lot of things seem to be going wrong in our lives, in this Tibetan Buddhist tradition, sometimes thinks that this is a sign that there's something very beautiful waiting to be born in our lives. And of course, I hoped this was true. And that all of these things are just a way, all these things going wrong are a way to get us out of the way so that we're not in the way of whatever it is that wants to emerge in our lives. And I do think, I think of that as a fearlessness practice. And again, I'll go down this one road, which is the next day after I was reading about this, I had lunch. This is a practice of mine that I've taken up a lot in the last few months is the practice of lunch, and I've been just calling. I've been, you know, I worked at Brush Dance for 15 years, and I was in this kind of CEO seat. And I was often, you know, too busy to have lunch. But since I've left, which is now it's just been a few months, I've been a compulsive lunch eater. And I found that it's a great time. I can call up almost anyone and suggest that I will take them to lunch, especially if I'm clear that I will pay for lunch. Almost everyone will say yes, I've noticed. And I've been having fabulous lunches, fabulous meetings, and I've been joking with my teenage daughter that this perhaps will be the title of my next book called Lunch. And but I was after I came across this idea that I mentioned about the when things go wrong, something beautiful waiting to be born. I had lunch in Berkeley with the CEO of a company. And I was sitting waiting for him for about 15 or 20 minutes, and he didn't show, and I got on my cell phone and called him, and he was very apologetic and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll be right there." And he, about 10 minutes later, he appeared, and he said, I've never done anything like this in my life. I never forget things, but suddenly, not only am I forgetting things, but all these things are going wrong in my life, and it's so strange and surprising. And I told him about that what I had just read, and he was not going for this at all. He was like, I don't believe in this New Age stuff, this Tibetan. I'm not a spiritual guy. Thank you very much, and let's have lunch. So we had lunch, and as he was standing up, he reached over this. It was a rainy day, and he reached up, and his umbrella fell on the floor. And as he reached over to pick up his umbrella, he knocked over the glass of water on the table, on our table, and it spilled on the woman sitting next to us at the next table. And as he reached to get a napkin to dry it, I thought to myself, something very beautiful is waiting to emerge in this person's life. But this practice of fearlessness is so many ways that are very practical and doable in our own lives. I mean but it's really difficult because it means giving up who we think we are, giving up ideas about what it is we think we want, what it is we think is happening, and to realize that this world that we live in is quite, quite unexplainable and miraculous. And I've come to it's in a way this may seem obvious that that we human beings are. We're capable of so much more than we can imagine, and Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, made the statement that the world is its own magic, and I think it's quite an amazing, beautiful statement to let that sink in. Well, what does that mean? The world is its own magic, and just how. How magical we are. Again, in the frame of this practice of generosity, how astounding and earth-shaking if we can let in that we've been given everything, right? That our bodies and minds and breath and everything. I mean, it's amazing, sitting in this beautiful building and to see it and experience it. And actually, it's easy to have an intellectual idea about it, but it's really challenging to really let it in and see how would we live our lives if we really let in that it's all gift and that and it's equally true though as magical and miraculous as we are, we're also pretty pathetic in a way, that we because we don't we don't let that in. And it's so hard to let that in, or it's so easy to be triggered by, why is that person driving so slow in front of me? And the day-to-day things at that level. But even at, I think of it, how difficult it is to feel that kind of generosity when we become aware of our own holding and patterns at what I think of as kind of a cellular level that it's really in our bodies, this holding and ideas and not being generous and not being fearless. We all seem to have a lot of training in that area. I had an experience, and this is one that, for me, really reverberates and has stayed with me. This was something that I experienced. It was in a couples therapy. I was in a therapy session with my wife, and somehow the space that got created, I noticed that things seemed slowed down more than they usually are. And I had this experience of I looked up at my wife and noticed, I kind of focused on the movement of her lips, and I became aware that when my wife's lip move in a certain way, that I could feel it in my shoulder, and that I was interpreting what that lip movement meant. In this case, it meant, look out. I'm not happy about something. And I began to actually respond to what I thought was being communicated, this I'm not happy about something. And in a way, it was completely automatic. That I think of it as a way in which my own interpretation completely bypassed central, right? It was not something that I really was thinking about. But in that moment, it was a really important insight for me. It was almost like seeing how much of our perception has this quality of a movie, of there being these frames in a movie, and to be able to slow it down enough, to be able to pay enough attention so that we can be aware of these ways that we're triggered, the ways that that we're always doing this, that we're always very, very subtly reading each other's energy. We're brilliant, you know, this is part of our brilliance. This is part of the magic of being a human being, that there's actually a part of our brain. You know, there's this wonderful book called Towards a General Theory of Love, which talks about how developed our limbic brains are, and that this is really what separates mammals from all other species, is this ability to read each other's energy. And in one way, this is quite beautiful from a Buddhist point of view. It points to, you know, there's this theory of emptiness. You know, often you might hear that Buddhists talk about that the basis of Buddhism is this philosophy of emptiness. An accessible definition of what this emptiness means is that the world is empty of separation, right? That we all are literally connected. That we're connected through the ways that we read each other's energy. That we know what each other are. We're good at really good at knowing what we're feeling, what other people are feeling and thinking. This practice of fearlessness is to be present for what the truth is, and not to be always putting our own always putting our own ideas and even not always taking these habits from our body and putting them on to ourselves and to other people, but to be fearless enough to shed all of this, all of these things that are extra. You know, and I think of you know, this giving the gift of fearlessness can seem pretty daunting, but I think it doesn't mean that we're not afraid, right? Because fear is just a natural part of being a human being. But I think this giving the gift of fearlessness means not being attached to things, not being attached to outcomes, and not being attached to our fear. To be able to see what we're afraid of and to move towards it. It's funny, I've started recently taking improv classes, and I kind of laugh at myself. It's like as though I need more places in my life to feel terrified. Because it's I always found to me running a business was a terrifying proposition. Being a father is a pretty terrifying proposition. I sat down at the dinner table the other day with my 17-year-old daughter, who she can go back and forth from if anybody who knows teenagers. None of us were like this, I'm sure, you know, of sometimes being really closed and angry, and then sometimes being just completely open and appreciative. And in this moment when we sat down, I could see this was the closed persona. And she looked up at me and posed what was quite a difficult question for me. She said, "Why is it that I seem to have taken on the worst qualities of you and Mom?" of course, I needed to inquire about that, and she was quite forthcoming with, you know, in great detail about what that was all about. Yeah, and actually though it was there is a way I so appreciate actually the fearlessness of, you know, that 17-year-old, because in a way she was telling her truth. I love seeing that when she's closed and grumpy, she's closed and grumpy, and when she's we walked into, I had to pick up something at Green's restaurant a couple of weeks ago, and she came with me. And she had been in there many times before, but it was like for the first time she saw there's this big redwood burl right in the, as you walk into Green's. And it was like she went over to it, and it was like tears almost started to come out of her eyes, and she kind of just went over and hugged this burl, and she, you know, she said to me, "Has this always been here?" That she had never seen it before, and most people don't see it, right? You kind of walk right by it. It's this redwood burl. It's, you know, where's my table? But I think this it's a kind of fearlessness to embrace our own grumpiness and closedness and see it, and also to embrace, you know, the wonder and magic of things as they really are. I think there's such a tendency, I think I have this tendency, right, to live in, you know, to not go to either of those ends very easily. I mean, who, you know, but I think I think sometimes this this hiding of our grumpiness, or even in this case that I talked about, in this hiding, this not seeing the way that we're triggered, not seeing the way we're holding these ideas about what other people think or want or who we are, the way we hold that in our body, and again, this practice of giving the gift of fearlessness is a it's kind of a radical, I think of it as a radical mindfulness practice, right? To really pay attention to what's going on, and to even to I'm recommending the practice of grumpiness. I'm also recommending, though, if you're going to take on the practice of grumpiness, don't leave out the practice of real appreciation, the practice of and try and have a higher ratio if you can, but it's okay to see the fear that we have, and to see how we hold ourselves back. I think what I'd like to do, I see, since we're not going to do a week sesshin, at least, I don't think so. I think what I want to do is read just a little section from my book, from ZBA, if that doesn't seem too, commercial, but, and then have some time for questions. I asked someone who comes to this group, I said I had the idea of getting you all into small groups so that you talk to each other, and he said, they hate that. And so I think I won't do that. Even though it might be good, because it would probably make you grumpy. But I think instead, I'll read a short section from ZBA, and then have some time for some questions or dialogue or whatever you all want to do. Yeah, I also had the thought, don't let me forget, if there's time, I thought we could sing something together at the end. That would be a way of me expressing my fearlessness of leading you in a song. We'll see. I did have something in mind. Right, so this book is called ZBA, Zen of Business Administration. And if you don't get, it's a joke. It's like you can get your MBA degree, but you can get your ZBA degree. Just read this book. It was a joke that someone had mentioned to me about. They asked me if I had my ZBA degree, and when I heard that, I thought it was pretty dumb, but it's stuck. Careful about that stickiness. So this is a chapter called Impermanence. Yeah. Okay. During the summer, when I was director of Tassajara, cold drinks and leftover sweets were served every afternoon to students and guests. One very hot August afternoon, shortly after the tea break, I was informed by one of our staff members that a student was feeling sick and needed to be replaced in the kitchen. A few minutes later, I was told that another student was not feeling well. Then someone came running up to me saying that a guest had suddenly become very ill and was having trouble breathing. Fortunately, two of the guests at Tassajara were physicians. One of them began asking what had been served for tea that afternoon, and discovered that a student had prepared a special tea that day made from fresh elderberries picked from the nearby hillsides. This physician knew that the bark and leaves of elderberries were quite poisonous, and that we needed to find and evacuate everyone who had drunk the elderberry tea. We discovered 10 people who were seriously ill. Tassajara is in the middle of a wilderness area, 2 hours from the nearest hospital. There is an emergency helicopter site located on the top of a hill protruding from the east end of the valley. I immediately went to the one telephone at Tassajara, a crank phone that required being connected to an operator in Salinas. And I called the emergency helicopter number. I told the man who answered the phone that several people were seriously ill and that we needed a helicopter flown in immediately. He responded by asking me, "How do I get to Tassajara by helicopter?" I couldn't believe this question. I felt that my senses had become completely open. I was watching and listening for clues and information about what to do and how to respond to this situation. About 45 minutes later, I could hear the sound of a helicopter approaching. I ran to the central part of Tassajara Valley to catch the attention of the helicopter pilot. I signaled for him to try to land in the center of the valley. I hoped to avoid having to carry sick people up a steep and narrow path to the top of the hill. As the helicopter descended into the valley, the wind thrown off by its rotor struck the steep valley walls, making it impossible to land. I then began to run towards the hilltop helicopter site and directed the pilot to where to land. 4 people were needed to carry each of the six sick people to the top of the hill and help load them into the helicopter. This was all that the helicopter could accommodate. The other 4 people who were in slightly better condition were driven to the hospital. I stood next to the helicopter as its large side door was slid shut and its motor revved. My heart sank as the helicopter slowly slid off the side of the top of the steep hill and quickly plummeted towards the bottom of the valley before swooping upward again. Everyone completely recovered. This helicopter driver was an old Vietnam vet and knew that the secret of flying off of these steep hills with hills surrounding was to drop down to the bottom and then come up. It's very exciting. It seems as though we have no choice but to act as though the world is permanent, solid, and predictable. And at the same time, we must realize that everything around us is impermanent, fluid, and unpredictable. If we go too far toward believing in permanence, we will be thrown when something unexpected happens. If we lean too far toward a belief in impermanence, we may fall into the trap of not setting clear goals, not achieving what is within our potential, and living irresponsibly. This can be a way of protecting ourselves from failure, or sometimes of protecting ourselves from success. The secret of successful business practice and life practice is finding the balance between control and letting go, between understanding that though little is within our control, we must act with complete responsibility. It is vital that we define our own paths, that we act with integrity, that we set clear goals for ourselves, and that we define and live by our life's purpose. At the same time, we must be prepared to change directions, to face whatever may come our way. You might say that the purpose of Zen and the purpose of business practice is to develop an open, flexible mind, a mind that can deal with a world that is both solid and completely impermanent. So that's the connection. If you were wondering, what connection could there be between Zen practice and business practice? So we do have a little bit of time for some questions or comments, and I thought I'd like to, given that the topic I'm talking about is fearlessness, I would hope that maybe people who don't generally ask questions, who are too afraid, might say something or ask something. But yes, please. I'm sorry, could you talk?
What you just read hit the nail on its head for me in terms of the question I had in my mind as to if I had a chance at the end of tonight I was going to ask you personally. And it's amazing, as if like you had read my mind and you read the piece I was most...
I did read your mind, yes.
So my question is, regarding what you just said and what you read, or more really what you just said after what you read, which is the that balance of not leaning too much towards either permanence or impermanence. Mm-hmm. How do you do that fine balancing act?
Yeah. So I was.
What's
I was
your suggestion for keeping
sure.
that balance?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I was having this discussion with someone from the improv world, and I love their response. They said, balance, forget about it. You know, don't try. And I actually thought that was pretty good advice, that what seemed much more useful to me in a way was presence, right? Was the practice of presence. Because our lives, I mean, yes, we do want to be aware of, you know, if we're working 16 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week, it's, you know, our lives might really be out of balance, and or if we're not working 16, but I think the practical practice comes to, again, I think this practice of this giving the gift of fearlessness, being fearless enough to actually be present for our lives, to be present. But what I love about this this giving the gift of fearlessness, it's like being present as a way of helping others, right? It's not just that we need to be fearless and present for ourselves, but the thrust of it is about awareness of other people and about being able to really be there fully in our lives. And I think that is a better definition or a better way to look at it than balance. What do you think of that?
It sounds good. what I should have said, I guess, as a prefix to my question was that maybe I have the wrong impression, but whatever exposure I've had to either Zen or the mindfulness meditation, I attend both, whichever I have time for, Zen or mindfulness meditation. I'm not really attached to either or. But from both of them, basically, whatever exposure I've had, whatever learning of the teachings I've had, it seems to me that there is more emphasis on impermanence.
Yes, because our...
And letting go. Let go, impermanence, let go, impermanence. And I was wondering that whether I'm leaning too much towards that, too mm-hmm. much towards everything is impermanent,
right.
Let go,
right.
And not considering the permanent part.
Yeah, I mean, in some way it's obvious why there's so much emphasis on impermanence, because in our culture especially, where we, you know, totally deny death, right, that we live as though everything is permanent, and that tends to be the place where a lot of people need that. But it's also true that there are a lot of people who are drawn to practice who need help in the other way. I sometimes talk about that. You know, we often look at, well, what does spiritual practice have to teach business? You know, how can we use spiritual practice in our business lives? And I like asking what I think is, you know, kind of a radical question: is what is it that business has to teach spiritual practice? And to me, one answer to that would be like energy and accountability. Right? One of the things that I like about the world of business is that it's pretty clear. It's pretty clear when you're failing or succeeding. You know, in Zen practice or spiritual practice, sometimes in my opinion, there can be too much leaning towards not giving people enough feedback about what things they need to work on. You know, that there can be a lot of feeling of forgiveness and impermanence in a way that what someone really needs is to get a job. or to see a therapist, or to be held accountable for certain things. So I think it's a really good question, and it's, you know, there's no answer to it, but I think it's useful to look at both sides.
Thanks.
Anything else?
I wanted to remind you about singing.
I was hoping you'd forget. it is 9:00. I'm hoping some of you know this song. It's one of my favorite. I think of it as it's something Dogen could have written but didn't, or Zen. The words are, "Hey ho, nobody home." Right? No eat, no drink, nor money have we none. Still, we will be merry. Just, I hope some people know how this song goes. Yes, thank you. So let's. I'll just start, and if you know it, please jump right in. And if you don't know it, please jump right in, and maybe we'll sing it. We'll sing it. I don't know, two or three times. We'll see what moves us. Hey ho, nobody home, no eat nor drink nor money have we none. Still we will be merry. Hey ho, nobody home, no eat nor drink nor money have we none. Still we will be merry. Hey ho, nobody home, eat nor drink nor money have we none. Still we will be merry.
Thank you very much.